shared with you some statistics that bother me, that 50% of Lutherans never speak to anybody about Christ, rarely. In other words, 90% rarely or never speak to anybody about Jesus Christ. And so the way that the Lutheran Church gains members primarily is through infant baptism, okay? As the baptismal rate goes up, then we go up. As it goes down, we go down. And we practice what I call gynecological evangelism. You know, we have babies and we go step forward. And I'm really concerned because in the 1980s in the state of Washington, the population grew by 17%. Would you think the Lutheran Church would grow by 17%? 16, 14, 12, 11, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Should we go into the negative? Is that the Lutheran Church declined slightly during that decade when you had enormous growth? And I ask why? And more importantly, I ask, does anybody care? I'm also keenly aware that 25% of our Lutheran congregations in the ELCA are not economically viable. By that I mean to say there's not enough enough people together to maintain a church and a pastor and those kinds of things. And just like, you know, if you grew up in rural America, the schools got so small so they had to consolidate. Remember that? Sometimes you wonder if that's going to happen. They have to happen in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in the future, that there's going to be a consolidation of a whole bunch of congregations in 30 years. I'm really concerned that we overachieve in the age cohort. And it's a fancy word, age cohort, but it's for people, it describes groups of people by age. So those over 75, we overachieve in that. And so in the population, there would be, instead of Washington, 58,000 people over 75, but we would have 100,000 in the Lutheran Church. Do you understand what I'm saying? We have twice as many as the population demographic for that age category in the older members. So I'm really concerned that when these people die, and if you're not replacing it and you're not reaching out to the new younger generation, you're going to be in trouble, is the conclusion. And I've seen this happen to the Methodist Church. The Methodist Church between 1950 and 1975 grew by, 4%, 4 or 5%. The population grew by 40%. There for 25 years, if you don't add new young people to your denomination for 25 years, you're in big trouble. And the Methodist Church is in big trouble because they haven't paid attention to this real basic fundamental aspect of Christianity, which is that we are to be witnesses for Christ. We are to go and make disciples. And so each of my sessions begin with that fundamental statement of facts. And my concern is that we need to go through a transformation in the Lutheran Church where members start to see themselves as missionaries. Right now, unfortunately, on too many bulletins, it says we sponsor a missionary in China. We sponsor a missionary in Japan. We sponsor a missionary in Tanzania. And people, because of that image, they don't see themselves as being a missionary. They think they have to go to the seminary to become a missionary. You think you have to go put in 2 years someplace to be a missionary. And it's that fundamental attitude where the laity do not see themselves as being missionaries. And it's in the laity, because the laity are always more effective than the clergy. And so that's the fundamental dynamic that I'm working with, trying to lift up for laity to assume the authority that they are missionaries. Okay, that's the fundamental persuasion. Now, what I'm going to do as I did last time, I'm going to preach a sermon. I'm basically a preacher. You know, I like to preach much better than I do the lecture. And then after that sermon, which was from a recent sermon in Epiphany, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to then get some information about magnet churches, those congregations which have large numbers of adult baptisms and affirmations of faith who do this kind of work. And we're going to study these congregations and see what we can learn from them. And one of you asked the question last time, well, how about those denominations which are growing? Why are they growing? And I would like to give you some information on that today, if we have time, okay? So that's the agenda for today. So grace to you and peace from God our Father and from our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen. The sermon for today grows out of the text from a few Sundays ago when it says, the harvest is plentiful. The harvest is ripe, but the laborers are few. Pray to the Lord of the harvest that the Lord of the harvest would send workers now to help harvest. That's the text that I'm going to be working with today. I bank at Seafirst Bank in Seattle, and I bank at Seafirst Bank because they have this deal. If you go and you stand in line, they have a little clock there that says if you wait more than 5 minutes, you get $5. And so I like to bank there, and I always go there on Friday afternoons when the lines are really long, and I always put it to the test to see whether or not, and I time it. Boy, I come in the bank, I time it right away. And inevitably happens. It gets to 4 minutes, four minutes, and somebody say, the boss will say, we need more tellers immediately. Not in 5 minutes, not in 10 minutes, not tomorrow. We need tellers now. And some person runs up there, and I have to go get in line. I lose my $5. I've been doing it for years, and I have never yet got my $5. I've tried on many, many Fridays. I've tried, but it doesn't work. Send workers now, and they come right there. Or have you ever been to the grocery store, Albertson, Safeway, you know, and you're standing in this long line of people, and you're fidgety, and you're late, and you want to go someplace, and you're saying, come on, don't they open up some other cash registers? You've had those feelings, haven't you? You stand in line, and about that time, there's a booming voice that comes over the microphone system in the grocery store and says, send tellers, send cash registers, send people, send John, Mary, and Matilda to the cash registers immediately. And all of a sudden, there's two or three people, and you like it. And they come now, and they say, not in 5 minutes, not in 10 minutes. I mean, they want them now. This is not a time for thinking about it. They want those cash registers up there at the grocery store now. And they come now. And if they don't come now, the boss gets a little irritated, to be quite honest. Or in Western Washington, we grow a lot of strawberries. And strawberries, you know, all of a sudden they become ripe. And this was a bad year for them. I mean, here in 1993, it was really wet and cold. But the strawberries usually ripen up very fast. And when they ripen up fast, then there's all kinds of announcements over the radio that says, we need workers out in the strawberry field now. Not a week from now, not a month from now. It doesn't work. We need workers now, and all of a sudden people come. All kinds of children come, families come, migrant workers come. All kinds of people go out and they pick them now. We need workers now, not a week from now. We need them now. Well, it's with this introduction that we approach the text for today, and it's in that spirit and mood that we approach the text for today, which is the call of the first missionaries. And where Jesus is calling the first of the 12 disciples, and he says, the harvest is ready. The strawberries are ready to be picked. We need workers now. Not in a week, not in a month, not in a year, not when they feel like it. The harvest is ripe now. Pray to the Lord of the harvest that the Lord of the harvest will send workers now. Now, this passage is part of the call of the first 12 disciples. Okay, this very famous evangelical statement or phrase or set of words is part of the call of the original 12 disciples. And what I would like to do today is look at the original 12 disciples and the call of the original 12 disciples to see if it can form a pattern, a paradigm, a prototype for us. To see if somehow we can learn something from the original 12 disciples in that original call and see if it applies to us. Now Jesus, it says in the text, was out doing two things. He was preaching of the gospel of the kingdom, telling people that God was near. God is nearer to you than you realize. God is very near to you. And he was preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and he was healing people of their diseases. He was meeting them in their real felt needs. He knew that they were hurting, and he was a person of healing towards them. When Jesus looked at those original people, as he looked out in the world, the text says, oh, they are helpless and hapless, like sheep without a shepherd. And that's my way, I think that's a Greek way of saying, boy, those people are all messed up. The world was all messed up, but the people he was running to were all messed up. And what was Jesus' attitude? His attitude wasn't condemnation. Oh, what a bunch of scumballs those people are who have messed up their lives so much. Nor was his attitude that of constructive criticism. Well, if they would have gotten their act together and done what I had told them a long time ago, they wouldn't have gotten in this mess in the first place. But it says in Greek, it says, the Greek is very strong. It says, Jesus had compassion for them. And the Greek word is that his stomach was turning, okay? He felt so terribly, so empathetically for these people whose lives were all messed up. He said he felt deep compassion for them. It wasn't condemnation. It wasn't constructive criticism. It wasn't a set of moralisms on how to get their life together. And so then Jesus chose his first 12 disciples to send them out into the world, to send them out into this messed up world to make disciples for him, to preach the gospel, and to heal those around him. Now, what were the names of those first 12? Let's have a little contest here. Matthew, and Matthew was a tax collector, right? And we know that a tax collector, well, even today, if you work for the IRS, you know, people, well, I don't work for the IRS, you know, that there's kind of a suspicion. But at that time, tax collectors were called, you know, they were thought to be crooks. Who else do we have? We have Matthew. James and John, sons of thunder. They had two hot tempers, right, you know? And they also had egos. They were both saying, who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God? Well, gee, mother, do I get to sit at the big table or not? You know, so they were, you know, people were struggling with their ego identity, wanting to be top banana. And they also had problems with the temper. They're sons of thunder. Peter. Oh, stick it in your mouth, Peter, right? Stuck his foot in his mouth, Peter. If the guy wanted to bungle it with the words, that was Peter. Who else do we know? Andrew, Peter's kid brother, and another fisherman, you know, and he's one of these guys who, like a lot of us, we live in our brother's shadow. Got the big fisherman, Simon Peter, does all the talking, gets all the glory. Lots of us live in the shadow of an older brother or sister, you know, who, you know, the oldest child syndrome kind of thing. But the Andrew comes along behind. Who else do we know? Judas. Oh, hey, Judas liked money too much, right? He was the guy who was the keeper of the treasure, right? He's the keeper of the treasure, betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, you know. Complained, you know, when they were spending too much on certain things, like money too much. A little sneaky about money. Well, who else do we know? Philip and Nathaniel. That was another story. That's another story. John Mark. He's the guy who wrote the gospel. Then there's Bartholomew. Who knows anything about Bartholomew? We don't know anything about Bartholomew. The point is, these were common and ordinary people, right? There was a tax collector, there was a big sinner, there was a guy with temper problems, with ego problems. We got this guy with foot and mouth disease. We got this guy who was kind of a little stingy, a little deceptive with money and all those kinds of things. And then Jesus says, I give you authority. This is the key line. I give you the authority to his first 12 disciples to go out and preach the gospel, to tell people that God is near, that the kingdom of God is near, that God is present and wanting to help them. He gave them, and secondly, to heal them of their diseases. Now, he didn't say to them, well, you know, after you spent 3 years for me, after you've been through Jerusalem Theological Seminary and got your PhD, after you've been through some counseling sessions, no. What blows my mind in this text is that Jesus immediately gives those common and ordinary people authority. Authority. Now, right now, a lot of people, well, I can't be a missionary, you know. I don't have the authority. I haven't been to the seminary. You know, I haven't been trained. I haven't been through the Bethel Bible Series, Crossway Church, and all those. I haven't been on the church council. I'm a common and ordinary person. How would God give that authority to me? That's the key line. Is that God gives these common and ordinary people authority to go and preach the gospel. And then he says to them, take nothing along with you. I like that story. He says, don't take along two sets of clothing. You know, don't impress people with your nice clothes. Say, oh man, if I become a Christian, I'll be able to dress like that. It says, don't take along an extra belt and extra gold and all that kind of stuff. Well, I become a Christian, I'll get some extra money in my pocket. No, all you have is the basic simplicity. All that you have is the basic simplicity. The gospel of Jesus' love, that God is present, that God's love is near you, wanting to help you with your life, put your life back together again. And secondly, to help people in their need, to be a healing person to them. That's all. That's all that they were given. No books, no lectures, no education. Send them out. Blows my mind what he did. Now, so how do we apply that today? Now, how do we apply that, what I call the original recipe? When I'm looking, you know how Kentucky Fried Chicken has the original recipe? You know, yeah, right? You know about the original? So what I'm trying to do is look at the original recipe of the call of the first disciple. That's what I'm looking at. What was at the core of that? What I'd like to suggest to you, that the first principle that we find in there is that the gospel of Christ is always connected to human need. I mean, Jesus looked out at the world around and said, man, is this place. They are helpless. They are hopeless, like people without a shepherd. Life is all messed up. And Jesus always connects the gospel, always connects the presence of God to lives that are all messed up. And we need to learn from Jesus. When we look at, I ask you a question. Do you think the world is a nicer place today than it was when you were a kid growing up? Do you think it's more safe and stable and kind and good? Do you think that the world is more messed up? That there's more messed up everything throughout the whole? I mean, isn't that our attitude? Don't we all agree that the world is essentially messed up? And occasionally our attitude may be, oh, you know, condemnation. Bunch of scumballs. If those people would have had their life together, they wouldn't be in such a mess. Or constructive criticism. Well, you know, if they would have just followed what the Bible said, things would have been better. But Jesus had neither attitude. And the evangelical church, the witnessing church, needs to have the heart of Christ. And the heart of Christ is to look out at a world what is all messed up. And to have a heart that burns with compassion. Now, you know people whose lives are all messed up. They may be your grandkids. They may be your children. They may be the neighbor down the street. They may be your own life. Who knows? But at the very heart of it, at the very heart of evangelical goodness is this fundamental compassion. And if it's criticism or condemnation, it never is helpful at all. Now it says, J.B. Phillips is a very favorite author of mine, and he wrote a book called Lectures on Preaching, 1877. And he gave me a wonderful quotation, and he says, the preacher's instinct, and you're the preacher, by the way, not me, the preacher's instinct is to feel instantly how Christ and human need belong together. I'm fundamentally convinced of that. At the heart of all good evangelists, all good missionaries, all good witnesses for Christ, is the preacher's instinct is to feel instantly how Christ and the need of that person are connected. No need is so great and no need is so small, for Christ will meet them in their need. I love that quotation. It's absolutely right. And so if you have a friend who's going through a divorce right now, you know, that if you're like, boy, you should have shaved up, buddy, you blow your marriage. Oh, no, that's, I think that Christ could really be helpful to you right now. You know, as you're going through the trauma and the tragedy of this divorce, and you're all bruised up inside, and you're not feeling good about yourself, and you're not feeling, and it didn't turn out the way you wanted to. I mean, God wants to help you. The love of God wants to be with you in that situation. I mean, the very heart of evangelism is always connecting the gospel to human need. Or let's say that you have a kid. Let's say you have some kids, and I'm thinking of a conversation I had the other day with a family, and they're not part of the church. And this young man, he was in his mid-30s, late 30s, and his mother was dying. And so I was there at the hospital in the waiting room, and we got talking. I said, you know, you got a couple of kids, I hear. Yeah. I said, man, I says, you love your kids, don't you? Oh, I really love them. I said, you know what those kids really need is Jesus Christ. The thing that can really help your kids more than anything else in the whole wide world is Christ. I mean, Christ and the presence of Christ and the love of the Christian community helps make better kids, and you want your kids to be better kids. He says, you know, I know, you know, I've wanted to have them baptized. I've wanted to get them into the Christian community. He says, well, let me tell you. Now, what you want to do is really connect your children to Christ in the Christian community. That's really important. But it's always connected to a human need. If you come up and say, oh, God is love, Jesus was raised from the dead, those are dogmas. But when you connect them to human need, then they become evangelical persuasions. Do you see? There's an enormous difference. Or we could just give hundreds of examples of where people are going through stuff. And where Christ and the love of Christ and the love of the Christian community can go hand in hand. So I really like that quotation where he says, a missionary's instinct is to feel instantly how Christ and human need belong together. No need is so great, no need is so small that Christ will not be willing to be part of it. And one time I heard a story about some people whose child was born blind, and there came a time in this family's life where his parents could have a surgery whereby the blind child could see for the first time. And they've been telling their child, their son, how gorgeous it was going to be. And they had told him, you know, that when he could see again. And they had the surgery, and he could see again. And he said, oh, Mom and Dad, you never told me how beautiful it was. They said, yes, we did. And he says, well, I didn't comprehend how beautiful it is. And I've heard so many unchurched people, when they come to know Jesus Christ and the healing, saving, wholesome power of the Christian community, they say, how come you didn't tell us about this, that this could happen to us, that our life could be made whole again? How come you didn't tell us about that? We say, oh, we told you about that. Just didn't comprehend. That's all. One time there was a story about a man who was selling filing systems. This guy was really good at selling filing systems. So he came to this business. And this business was making a lot of money. And he said, you know, what you need is a filing system to really help you in your business. And they bought the whole thing. And this company became all fascinated with this filing system and spent all kinds of time now filing, and they weren't doing their business anymore. In fact, they spent more time filing than doing their business. But man, their company got organized. And sometimes I feel that's going on in the church. We are into a filing system. We've got our computers now. And let me tell you, we keep track of it, worship attendance and communion attendance, and we keep track of all that stuff. And the primary purpose of the church becomes keeping track of all the members in our filing system rather than the original business that we were to be in, which was to go out and make disciples of all people, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So what I'm saying at the very heart of evangelism, it's a messed up world out there. I don't know about you, but I know that you have already told me that you think the world is really messed up. And by that, you have implied there's a lot of messed up people out there with messed up lives who desperately need the wholesome healing power of Christ in the Christian community. And how do they get it? It's when the laity understand that they have the authority to go and be missionaries for Jesus Christ. Well, the second thing that I find in this lesson for today is that every Christian is to be an evangelist. As we look at this original 12, the original recipe on the Kentucky Fried Chicken, the original recipe of the call of the first 12 disciples, it is at the very heart of Christianity that all Christians are called to be witnesses for Christ, that all Christians are called to be missionaries. A missionary is not somebody you just send off to Tanzania, Madagascar, Namibia, or China, Japan, or someplace else. It's one of the greatest disservices to the church. And see, we inherited that from Martin Luther, right? Because Luther thought the end of the world was going to come in his lifetime and all that kind of stuff, so he didn't want to send off missionaries. You know what? It took the Lutheran church a long time before it sent off its first missionaries. And we've inherited that predisposition. We are members more than missionaries. And it's that kind of attitude which worked as long as we had cultural Christianity with Norwegians, Swedes, and Germans, and Danes. That doesn't work anymore. Well, who did Jesus call? Well, Judas, you know, liked money too much. James and John with their hot tempers. Peter with his foot and mouth disease. And the fundamental thing, as I've shared with you, is that these people were given authority. Let's just look at he gave authority. Remember, he hadn't spent any time with them, had he? Right? Had Jesus spent any time? He called them, right? He called them. What did he do? He sent them out. Would have you been a little nervous? Sent out? I mean, but that's at the heart of it. You're just sent out to tell about the love of Christ. You're sent out to tell about the love of Christ and how it connects with people in need. And that's the way people are brought to Christ. Now, when I think of evangelists, I think of TV evangelists. Do people think of evangelists? Do you think of TV evangelists? I do. Tell me, let's ask a question. What percentage of people in the life of the church become Christians because of TV evangelists? 1/4 of 1%. 1/4 of 1%. How many of you were brought into the life of faith because of TV evangelists? Well, you know, I had 700 people at our church one Sunday. None of them had. You know, I gave this last week, and none of them had. You know, none of them had been brought in by a TV evangelist. Now, I'll ask you another question. How many of you became people of faith because of some human being, like a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, an aunt, an uncle, a friend? Can I see your hands? How many of you were brought to faith that way? That's the way it works. That's the way it works. See, it's the way the faith has always worked that way. The faith has always worked that way. And the evangelists are the common and ordinary people like you and me. And as I was sharing, as we were talking at the end of the last time, I think, how come the laity are just so much better at it than pastors? Well, we're going to talk about that later. So I was trying to think in my sermon for that Sunday, I was trying to think of somebody who I saw as being a really good missionary in our church. And I thought of Kim Wigington. Now, Kim Wigington must be about 28 years old, single woman. Came to our church riding on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And her grandma and grandpa, she came down from Alaska, and her grandma and grandpa were really upset. She said, "Don't tell my grandma and grandpa that I'm riding a motorcycle." She didn't want them to know. Well, one day, and then Kim Wigington worked as a checkout person over at a grocery store, all right? And one day, she read in the Federal Way newspaper, that's where I live, about the Cornyn family. Now, the Cornyn family in Federal Way have adopted 50 hard-to-place children. 50. All multiracial. And this was incredible. And Kim went out there and looked at these people, you know, and looked at this situation. And she said, "You guys need any help?" Well, come on, let's get real. If you have 50 kids, do you need any help?
Yeah.
If you have 50 kids with some real basic disabilities, do you have any help? Well, sure they had help. Well, come on out. And Kim started out there doing all kinds of stuff for them. She got some carpenters in our church down there to make, you should have seen all the bathrooms they made for the girls. I mean, they made all kinds of bathrooms for the girls. It was incredible. They didn't have nearly enough sinks and all those kinds of things. And she was helping them in their need. And she said to the kids, "You know, I'm really a Christian. Do you, any of your kids want to come to church?" Obvious question. And then one came in her car, and then two came in her car, and then three came in her car, and she said, "Can I have a church van, please?" And we filled the church up with Cornyn kids. That's the best evangelism program I ever had, you know, at our church. And it was meeting. It's such an obvious example. It's such an obvious example where you're helping somebody with the gospel in their real felt need. And it so happened that one of the children in the Cornyn family died. That happens in their life situation. And so they gave them the church bus, and Kim drives the bus. And it was the first time the whole family could go any place together. And they all went to the funeral of one family, all in the bus together. The first time the family had ever gone any place. And I'm saying, that's who a missionary is. A missionary, you don't have to go to Tanzania, Madagascar, Japan. You know? And the old style, that is, we have this Norwegian, Swede, or German, or Dane, or Finn move into the neighborhood whose name is Peterson or Johnson. She will find their way to the church through the yellow pages. If that is your attitude, your church will be dying very, very quickly. And so we need to go through what is called a paradigm shift. We need to go through the way we do things, where the laity understand that they are the missionaries, the primary missionaries of the church. So that's my second point, that every Christian is to be an evangelist. And the third point about Jesus, we want workers now. And I went to the grocery store the other day, and there was a long line, and I was kind of irritated, and then that voice said over the intercom and said, we want workers up to cash register 2 and 3 now, not 5 minutes late. Boy, they hustled, man. They understood who was boss, you know? They hustled. They came right under. They understood the boss was. And the people said, hey, the strawberries are so ripe, they're ready to be picked. We need workers now. Not in a week. They're all going to be rotten. They'll all be dead. The strawberries will become rotten if they're not picked now. And so people went out, and Jesus said, you know, the harvest is plentiful. There's a whole bunch of people out there whose lives are really messed up. They need the goodness of Jesus Christ. They need the wholeness of the Christian community. Pray to the Lord of the harvest that the Lord of the harvest will send workers now. Not next week, not next year. We need workers now. Amen. Well, that was an evangelism sermon from a few weeks ago in the life of our church. Forever trying to persuade the members of our congregation and now other congregations what it means to be a missionary for Jesus Christ. And the fundamental thing I've been trying to work with in all of this is that we need to reclaim the laity as the primary missionaries of the church, the primary witnesses of the church. And the whole idea of having a dynamic pastor with a dynamic choir doesn't last very long. So now let's take a look at what we call magnet churches. Now, magnet churches are those churches that have statistically have an unusually large number of adult baptisms and congregations of faith. And I don't have these in the proper order, so I'm going to shift it a little bit. And you can see my overhead here. Magnet churches, they vary in size and they vary in setting. You can find real small little magnet churches, or you can find great big churches which are magnet churches. Just because you are a big church does not mean that you're a magnet church. Or just because you're a little church doesn't mean that you aren't one. A magnet church is a church which has gone through a transformation whereby that congregation now sees a primary emphasis within the congregation is to go and make disciples of Jesus Christ. They have gone through that transformation, and it has to occur throughout the whole area. Now, so we've only studied these churches, right? We've only studied these churches. Now, I'm going to start with what I call the motivated way. And here it is, number 3. We're going to make number 1. Because I think that's much more accurate. A motivated way, in a sense, they want their church to grow. How unusual. They want their congregation actually to grow. And by the way, if you start to get a lot of unchurched people coming into the life of your church, they really mess up your worship services. By that, I mean their kids often don't know how to behave. They make all kinds of noise. When you start to have people who don't know church manners to come to your church, it makes a difference. It really does. It's no longer quite as smooth as it used to be. All right? But the whole thing, and there's 5 crucial behaviors. And these 5 behaviors, and I keep on saying, we're not asking an elephant to become a dinosaur, or we're not asking a zebra to become a giraffe. We're talking about 5 simple behaviors within the laity that are absolutely crucial. And the first is this, is that they pray. Is that they be people of prayer. And the primary prayer is for us. It's not for the unchurched person that they would open up their heart to Christ. The primary prayer is for me to be more apostolic, to be more loving, to connect Christ to their need, to reach out to them. That's the prayer. And so every Sunday morning, I know in the prayers of our church, we always pray for our congregation. That's part of the prayers of the church. Everyone helping us to be motivated to see ourselves as missionaries. And then praying for our congregation and praying that we would be witnesses for Christ and have essential. Now the second thing that's really important that we're going to talk about in session four is talking to other people about Christ. Now I have that statistic that I've gone through with you before, that Biesenthal's in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church said that in their study that 50% of Lutherans never and 40% rarely spoke about Christ. I also have the statistic that 75% of active Christian parents in the mainline denominations never speak to their kids about Christ. So why is it such a surprise that we're losing our kids to other denominations? So, and there are many ways to do that, but several years ago, I wrote this thing that was called Witnesses for Christ. It's been used now by about 5,000-6,000 parishes. This kind of blows my mind. And last week, there was a pastor here who's taught it for 10 consecutive years. Some pastor down in California. And when this was written, it was written during the time when marriage encounter was so big, and you had to use the hot pen technique. You had to write down your feelings real intensively about what you felt about your wife, and then she let them read them, and that kind of thing. And then you talked about those things. And so that was real hot. So what I did, the key to this course is real simple. At each of the class periods, you write down, who are the people who really, why are you part of the church? Let's ask that question. Why is the church important to you? And you write that down. What do you believe? Why is Christ important? You write that down real, real hard. You know, not the right answer, but just hard. And then you pair up, one-on-one, and you share with each other what you wrote. And then you guys share with each other, and you share with each other. And throughout the course then, it's 10 weeks long, is you'll have 20, 30, 40 conversations with different people in your class on religious issues. I'm just trying to get people to be more comfortable talking about Jesus Christ. But it's absolutely essential. And the other thing is to make sure you never start to talk like a preacher, that you never talk like me or your pastor, that you people talk about Christ much simpler, much more earthy. It's much more earthy. It's down to earth. It's an enormous difference. You can tell when somebody's a professional Christian or not. It makes all the difference in the world. But the talk to other people about Christ in the church is absolutely essential. Just absolutely essential. And then the great prayer is the third category. Your natural points of contact. Now that's my point about Lutheran pastors. The longer you are and more active you are in the Lutheran church or any other church, the fewer unchurched friends you have. Now who is probably the most active person in the Lutheran church? It's the pastor, okay? And the pastor, so I read in the studies, the pastor is working on the average about 60 hours a week. I'm sorry, the pastor is totally surrounded almost entirely by church people. So he would be the worst possible person to ask because he doesn't have any unchurched friends. And so the key is the laying of all kinds of unchurched friends. And the key to me is that especially is if you get into people who are in health programs like in Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, or any of these groups, they have so many unchurched friends, it just blows your mind. And they're all at these AA meetings and NA meetings and OA meetings, you know. And if you ever get somebody who comes into your church through one of these groups, boy, they have so many friends, and just they bring them. It's incredible. Unchurched people, the more unchurched they are when they come into the life of Christ, the more unchurched friends they will have. It becomes really important. To bring our friends, our natural points of contact. To be friendly on Sunday morning. To be friendly on Sunday morning. I could show you the research that, and I'm not going to do that, but I could show you the research and prove to you that the friendliness of the congregation is higher when you ask unchurched people, why did they join this congregation? And the friendliness of the people is second. And the sermon is sixth. Okay? The top one is the friendliness of the pastor. And the second one, right along with it, is the friendliness of the congregation. People are looking for affirmation. They're looking for kindness. They're looking for welcome. They're looking for hospitality. So this friendliness thing on Sunday morning is very, very important. And then another major issue is to become friends. Is to become friends with these new people. It's very important to become friends. The research tells us, and if you can remember this, the research tells us that if a new person joins a church, an unchurched person, and they have seven or more friends in 6 months, 100% of them stay. Seven or more friends. They can know people, they'll call them up, invite them to things, 100% stay. If they have four or fewer friends, 92% of them drop out. Blows your mind. When you start to chew on that apple for a while, and when you find that people have, when they've been part of the church and they don't develop friendships in the life of the church, they drop out. And that's why small group home Bible studies are so important. You get a person into a small group home Bible study. One of you suggested the other day, you told me that one of these churches in Chicago required that. They required that when you went through membership to be a member of that church, you had to be part of a small group Bible study. But they're not done. When you become part of a small group Bible study, you now have 10 people you know. And the probability of keeping those people is absolutely essential. You see, and important. And the way you keep people is to get them involved in a small group of activity. Most of us do it this way. We assign them a sponsor who doesn't follow through. And it's just one or two people. And it never works. So this thing about becoming friends is absolutely essential in the life of the church. So those are five things we need. We haven't asked anything that's exotic, unusual, you know? There are five things we need. Well, another thing that the motivated lady, and then the related to that one, that's number four, is fellowship. To create significant and satisfying relationships within the church. And those are some of those important ratios here. And what I call a 1-7 ratio, and that's in the far left. And this is out of the Church Growth Institute research. And in their studies in the church, it says that if one new member has seven friends, 100% of them stay. Now the people in our church understand that. I'm not saying that they do it, but they understand that when new people come into the life of the church, they understand 1-7. That's Markwort 1-7. Instead of John 3:16. Markwort 1-7. One person needs seven friends. It's just real basic. Real basic. But if you are interested in being a congregation, which is a mission congregation, you need to understand these things. Another thing that's really important is 60 and 100. And that is they have 60 kinds of jobs for every 100 confirmed members. And people join the church, they like to become ushers, they like to become, to go visit nursing homes, they like to become involved in some kind of a structure in the life of the church. And so the church growth people say that they need to have 60 kind of work jobs for every 100 adults. The next one is 7 and 100. You need to have 7 small groups for every 100 confirmed members. 7 small groups. And the whole meta-church, principle, meta meaning the changed church. The church has gone through this change where they see themselves a missionary church. At the heart of that is providing small groups for them. 1-5, as the 1-5 ratio is to have one new member for every 5. In your church council, if you have 5 people in your church council, one of the 5 is a new member, newly baptized. Where you work with the leadership of the church. And the last ratio I find very important, because congregations don't know how to staff themselves. Lots of congregations are staffed for maintenance rather than staffed for growth. And you have to have at least one professional person for every 150 people in worship. So let's say that you have 250 people in worship. You need to have a pastor and a youth director, or two pastors, however you have it. And lots of churches are understaffed. They are staffed for maintenance. By the way, the church which is the worst church in size in terms of evangelical outreach is the single pastor who has 700 members at 700 member congregation and has 200 people at worship, or you know, between 200. That person, I studied those churches by size. Those churches have very few adult baptisms in affirmation disciples. Because the pastor is working so hard just to take care of the congregation that, you know, it just doesn't happen. So it's really important to have the right leadership ratio. And the reason is that one needs to have about 1/3 of the worshiping members, not that bad. 1/5 that's leadership position of the church council, things like that. If you have an altar, you have an altar with 10 energy, that's in the new member. Right?
So that's not paid.
No. This is, I'm sorry if I'm... Okay, let's say a job in the church. People join the church. You have to have some kind of job. Okay? This is leadership. This is called their leadership. I think half of the stuff in the church time. Yeah. Like that. Try to get people in the leadership. Let's say that we have 15 members of the church. 15 members. If you have 3 who are relatively new to the church. And if we have 15 new people, because you don't want to have the same old guard running the church all the time. You've been running for the last 20 years. Right? Yeah, and they burn out. But it's just pulling these people into responsibility and leadership capacity in some way. Now, a couple of other steps that are really important are pastors. And pastors have 4 qualities. Now, this one is a study of the Southern Baptists. And the Southern Baptists have done very well in evangelism. And the Southern Baptists say that there are 4 primary characteristics of pastors. The first one is warm and caring. Now, that also conforms to the research that Milo Brecky did on congregational tools for effective evangelism in 1986. What people are looking for from a parish pastor who knows Christ is that person is warm and caring to the members of the congregation. In the old days, you know, you could be a stuffed shirt and be a parish pastor. The people aren't into that today. They are into that remote formality. People want people where there's a kindred spirit between them, warm and caring. Secondly, that they are leaders. And leaders mean that they have vision for mission. Vision for mission. And that means that they may have they're pushing their congregation, encouraging them to be involved in the food banks, to be involved in taking care of the homeless, with AIDS, with all the different ministries that are around you. But so and all the research says that the best way to activate a passive church is to get them involved in some kind of mission program. Some kind of mission. And that's same with depressed people. If you have somebody who's really depressed, you want to get them out of the funk that they're in, a good way to do that is to get them involved with somebody else so they don't think about themselves. Well, the best way to get a congregation out of its funk is to get them involved with a local food bank, things like that, homeless ministry. The world's so screwed up around us, it's easy to find things to tie into for congregations. But the pastors have vision for ministry. The third characteristic is that they are biblical preachers. There's nothing about the word dynamic. There's nothing about the word dynamic. It says biblical preachers. They are expositors of the word. And they also are good Bible teachers. And so their authority is in the Bible rather than in the charism of their own personality. And the next one that they're evangelistic. They're doing what I'm doing right now. You know, that is, they are motivating their congregation. So I call up this guy. I call up pastors who are good at this stuff. Now, be honest, there aren't a whole lot of them. There aren't. And so what I do is I call up those that are. And I say, hey, what are you doing that's kind of interesting? So I call up this guy one day by the name of Bob Holm over at Silverdale. And he says, you know, I was down there in Texas, and I saw this congregation down there, and they had this big sign as you left their parking lot. You are now entering your mission field. So Oh, that's cool. And so I go to the church council and say, I got a good idea here from this friend of mine. Let's put these big signs as you leave the our parking lot. You are now entering your mission field. I had more positive comments on that little thing, you know, from members of the congregation. The point is that at the heart of this is that the pastor is concerned about evangelism. Now, there are ways to do this, by the way. I was so pleased last week in this class, there was a woman here from Shelton, Washington. And their church is one of these churches that were just kind of going along down, slowly downhill. Right? And what they did, nice small congregation, they brought in a consultant. And they brought in a consultant. And his name was Bill Williams from Seattle. Okay? He's a lay person. And he comes and he works with his congregation for several months. And that woman told me their congregation is entirely changed. It's going a new direction. Now, they didn't go and get themselves a new pastor. You follow me? What they did is that the pastor and the laity together went to work on this. They went to work on this. And I think that there are people who can come in and help congregations to get going on these kinds of things. And almost every synod has a evangelical resource people who can come in and meet with your congregation to help move the congregation in that way. Or maybe you don't need an outside consultant. But all I know is that this factor has to be there. The pastor must be concerned about it. And then the last quality I want to mention is worship services. Boy, those are absolutely essential. Worship services and worship services, which if you have a traditional worship service, you should also try to get a contemporary one. That's the real basic thing. That they're uplifting, that the gospel of Christ is proclaimed. So these are some of the important issues. And I would suggest to you, and I've seen this again and again, I see congregations that really grow, which have large numbers of adult baptisms and affirmations of faith. And it is not dependent on having a charismatic leader pastor. No. It's rather doing the work of evangelism. You know, you can be a charismatic gardener, but you got to go and do the gardening stuff to make your garden grow. I'm sorry. You have to do the stuff to make your garden grow. And I'm saying that if you want to be evangelical, you want to be a magnet church, a missionary church, there's certain things you need to do to make this stuff become more primary. Now, secondary characteristics.
I have a question.
Yeah.
About number three, yeah. Motivated laity. This is very selfish, yeah. But having been in now two mission congregations
right.
that were little, and when you're a mission congregation, you are about building. You
right.
are about bringing people in and wanting to grow.
Right.
Then we stayed in this congregation for many years, and we grew and plateaued and became kind of a middle. And you
right.
know what? We lost a lot of those characteristics. We
right.
weren't as friendly
yeah.
anymore.
Right. Right.
And I didn't want to go to a church where I had my little set of people that I always went and talked to,
yeah.
and you didn't know everybody anymore. And so you'd kind of say, well, you know, gosh, have I seen this before or not? And you don't want to
right.
appear stupid, so
right.
you don't. You stick with the same people that you know.
Right.
You lose, at least it appeared to me, and I did it too. I lost some of that, hey, you're new here, want to get to know you, because
right.
I didn't know who was new and who wasn't new
right,
anymore.
Right, right.
So how do the larger churches go against that? Because you really don't know from week to week. If you have 700 members or 1,000 members,
yeah.
you don't know who's coming in there every week.
Right, right.
How do you guard against that?
Well, the important thing is you try to persuade your congregation that it's really important to be friendly on Sunday morning. And, hello, I'm not sure I know your name. You know, we probably met before. Who are you? And one of the questions you don't ask, are you a member? You know? I've been here for 14 years. Have you? And you don't want to. I've been here for 14 years too. Oh, gee, you know. See, you don't. You learn what one's not to do. All right. You learn what one's not to do. Yes.
like a name tag?
Lots of people, lots of congregations do that.
Some of them I know people stand up and others just sort of are the name we were talking about.
That's such a, every congregation does that differently, you know, about identifying people. And we don't do that. I don't want to embarrass people to do that. And what we do is we have a, you have this, you're supposed to, we do it once a month. We try to do it more often. We have a badge that says, that you put on your name, your name tag. And then we put M for member and V for visitor. And we do that on a regular basis. And so people have a V on, but everybody's got a name tag. And you can see if it's a V or a M. And it just kind of is, it's kind of a helpful little tool. And we do that, and it's, we like that. But other congregations, you know, they have people stand up and those kinds of things. We've felt uncomfortable by doing that.
They're kind of thinking if they were to raise their hand or just acknowledge what happened and being able to draw people's attention to the fact that they were new but not actually.
The other thing that's been really important to us, you know, we have worship registration cards that's there. And behind the worship registration card is about that long. And then we have one that's behind it in the pew rack that's that long that says visitor information. And for people to sign that out, and we get lots of good stuff from that. So they really clearly see that visitor information card very clearly in the pew rack. And it's taller than the other one, so it's very visual. And that's been a helpful tool.
But those cards are much less effective than person to person.
Oh.
You don't get near
friendly.
Right. That isn't friendly.
Yeah. Nothing replaces friendly on Sunday morning. That's absolutely critical. And even a visitor welcome person, you know, as they come in the door, they have a professional greeting. That isn't, but you can walk into a congregation and you can see within 30 seconds whether or not this is a friendly congregation or a stuffed shirt congregation. You can tell in 30 seconds whether or not the people are enjoying with each other, talking with each other, greeting each other. You can just feel it. I mean, it's real clear. That's real clear. And people, we all give off these social signals very quickly that, you know, affect us one way or another. Other questions? I have more stuff, but let's finish with that. And what I'll have to do is go over my other materials last time showing about why certain denominations are growing more effectively than others. But let's pause right now and let's have some more questions. Yeah. Yeah, right. Obviously, you will, I think that if you have a real declining economy with people moving out, you know, that's tough for every church. And if you have a very growing economy with growing numbers, that's really helpful. That's tough. Right. No, it's not a universal problem. But it certainly is one that I've been down in the San Francisco Bay Area where I've done preaching evangelism seminars down there. And those pastors really are concerned about that. And it's universal. And they use the phrase up and out. There's a lot of money down there. So I've been told. And I don't know. But so I've been told. And there are a lot of people who are up and out and are not really concerned about things of the Spirit. And so it's a tougher environment. I think that Los Angeles is another really tough environment in which to work. So I think that there are places which are just more difficult than other places. And therefore, but that still doesn't violate, it still doesn't invalidate those principles. Other kinds of questions? Yes?
In a very small congregation, I find that my problem is, it kind of reminds me of that old World War I song, Keep the Home Fire Burning. And we want to go out to various ministries that are, you know, in the community, but there's still got to be some when these visitors come that we're going to invite, there has to be something there
for them. Some kind of ministry program.
To invite them to, who's doing that stuff while other people are volunteering in all the places of the community?
To be honest, and this is a very controversial thing to say, I wish congregations, certain congregations would consolidate with other Lutheran congregations in the area, just like they did with the old schools, you know, years ago, and created a larger base with which to work. I think it really is hard for real small, older congregations. That's very, very hard to do this kind of thing. And I think it would be wise, and I know we as Lutherans are really into congregational autonomy, and we really like our congregations, and we have real long-term connections. But sometimes I think you need, at least in the old wooden schools, where I went to school, my kids and my family goes to school, all these rural small towns have all consolidated their school systems. So they have a large enough school system in mass to get things done and provide a really good education for them. And I wish that there was more thought about some consolidation of some old...